the land.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomena. And our guest today needs no introduction to the alien contactee community. Tom Reed has been in the public's eye since he, along with his brother, mother, and grandmother, were abducted in 1969 in Sheffield, Massachusetts. The Reed incident made new headlines in 2015 when it became the nation's first UFO encounter to be officially inducted into the archives of the United States as, quote, historically significant and true. Massachusetts Governor Charles D. Barker, Lieutenant Governor Karen E. Polito, and the Massachusetts Historical Society validated the incident with an official state citation. A 5,000-pound commemorative monument was unveiled at the scene of the encounter. However, recently a crew from the town of Sheffield Highway Department removed the monument, and Mr. Reed has begun legal proceedings for its wrongful removal. Tom, now retired, was the founder of the international model and artist group Miami Models South Beach. His late father, Dr. Howard Reed, was an attorney, college professor, in public office. His grandmother was the governess for William Roosevelt, the grandson of President Roosevelt in Cherry Hills, Colorado. The UFO incident has been the subject of several programs and documentaries, such as the Discovery Channel's Alien Mysteries. And Reed has been featured on Ancient Aliens, Good Morning Canada, Inner Space, Paranormal Paparazzi, and Uncovering Aliens. And we're happy to have him on the show with us today. Hello, Tom.
Hey, how you doing, Dave? Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you coming on. And, so we'll get right into your abductions scenarios there prior to 1969 experience in Sheffield, Massachusetts. You were, shall I say, indoctrinated with alien contact as far back as 1966. Tell our listeners about that incident.
Well, we had a lot of activity in the area growing up. I'm not sure how much your listeners are aware of, but we lived on a horse farm. So we had about 80 acres of property, and it was a pretty high altitude. It was pretty much higher than anyone else in the area, or at least, you know, maybe a couple homes in the area, but it was pretty high up. I'm almost 2,000 feet above sea level. And we had all this land, if you will. A lot of it was like alfalfa fields, so it was open, you know. And we lived around, you know, Command Aerospace, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky Aircraft, GE. You know, there was just a lot of military manufacturing facilities, I guess you could say.
Okay.
And so when a lot of people in the area, it wasn't just us, were seeing things or having encounters with what, you know, whatever. A lot of it, we never knew exactly what it was. So many things were seen that looked like a round sphere that was self-contained light, which is still seen today. That area or that pocket in Sheffield, Mass., Great Barrington, Mass., or the Southern Berkshires, still to this day has a lot of the same activity it had back in the 60s when we first laid our eyes on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, there was never a question whether or not these things were affluent in the area or not. You know, there was very well documented. There's even pictures of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And even Salem, Mass. Had a lot of very similar activity. So with that said, I was 6 years old when I first saw something that could be contributed to an off-world incident or a UFO, if you will, or a being. The first thing that I really remember was sitting in my bedroom with my brother talking and getting ready for bed, and my mother came in and she had said, I want to shut the window, because back in the day we didn't have, you know, AC, you know, we had a screen in the window,
mm-hmm.
and we let the air in, you know, and so she shut the window because she said, I think it's going to rain. I see lightning, but I don't hear any thunder, but I still think it's going to rain. And so she shut the window, and these lights that she had seen over the farm or over a house, this 80 acres of property and horses, I mean, the horses were getting bothered by it, you know, they'd suddenly, you know, make a little noise and trot away, and there was something wrong with that feeling, that vibe that you had. And sure enough, my brother and I were going to bed, and next thing you know, I'm looking at the walls, and I'm seeing what looks like orbs, if you will, or a small little sphere. I mean, people tend to really get hung up on orb or sphere, but to me, I don't know what it was. Was it an orb? Was it a sphere? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you, it almost looked like a bubble. Like if you blow a bubble, you know, it pulls away. You know,
right, man.
It almost looked like a bubble. In the air, and I sat there and I watched this little sphere or orb go along the wall where at the foot of my bed, along the wall right next to the ceiling, and it kind of went to the left and it would fade out and come back, and it actually made the turn at that 90 degree turn when it ended up at the far end of the wall, which met the wall coming, you know, towards the bed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it actually made that turn. And as it got around to the closet, it kind of faded out. But I remember staring at this and along these flashes outside the window that almost looked like odd lightning strikes, but they went across the sky, not down towards the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And they were almost forming, almost like my mother had said, it almost looked like it was forming, you know, tic-tac-toe type shapes in the sky, these lights, these mm-hmm. little thin bursts of light, which some might consider it to reflect and say, okay, well, maybe that, you know, could have been lightning, but not the way that it was firing, you know, sideways.
Right.
And so the combination of that was the first thing that we ever saw, my brother and I. And we have some very odd memories of the mid-60s. There was more than one incident back then that my brother and I were certain that we were involved in something quite extraordinary.
If I may interrupt, back to these little orbs, is it possible that was a ball lightning?
No, this was inside our room.
Right, well, ball lightning can go inside a building, but usually they just dart around. This sounds like this was moving awfully slowly.
Oh, probably, it probably took 5 to 10 minutes for this thing to go 10 feet along my wall.
Oh, then it wouldn't be ball lightning.
And what was, and to clarify outside, it wasn't as if this was lightning that was, you know, lightning's grounded, right? So it comes right down to the ground. It wasn't coming down, and it wasn't like a flash like that. It was almost like a tic-tac-toe grid in the sky that would appear for a second and then vanish with no sound, no thunder afterwards.
Wow.
So it was almost like these weird little cross goldish bright lights that appeared for a second in an odd shape and disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very strange. And so with that, that was really the first thing that we experienced as children that was off, you know, that we weren't quite sure how to react to that. And and along with these events in the 60s, we weren't the only people in the area that were reporting this type of thing. And it wasn't until 69 that everything seemed to come full circle. I mean, we had the diner in town. My mother used to own the Village on the Green Diner in Sheffield, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
It was on, I think it's 113 Main Street. That's how small this town was. And to give you an idea of how rural this was, we didn't have a middle school.
Oh.
I mean, even today, there's only 3,000 people or so in that community.
Wow.
It's considered a village.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we had, you know, Sheffield Center School, which went to fourth grade, and then we had the high school. And so with that said, our diner was not far from the elementary school. And with that being, it was really the only eatery in town, my mother used to run a tab for the kids. And because it was so rural, the school buses, and this is important, the school buses didn't go to the individual homes of these people or some, you know, general corner wherever kids could meet, because it was so rural, the bus just went down the main road, and it was up to the parents to drive their kids a half a mile or whatever it was to get them to the school bus. And rather than do that and have to wait for the bus, they could basically just grab their children and bring them to the diner, and we would run a tab. They could have breakfast together and, you know, walk or ride their bikes to school, because their fathers, for the most part, were farmers. You know, your cows or horses. So it was up to the mother, just bring them to the school, you know, bring them to the diner across from the school.
Right.
And so those children that were brought to the restaurant, if you will, or our diner, are the same people today that have helped get this case inducted into state, because they were all part of it. And that's what's really unique about this. And with that, you know, 69, I don't know if your listeners have any idea what really happened, but again, I was brought up on horses, and I was riding in 1969, September 1st, at a 4-H horse show. And following the, which is still in the papers, you can still find the articles, following that, my mother had left the cook at the diner to... let's hope to keep it open later for business, because it was a holiday. And so after the competition, we went back to the restaurant and to make sure it was locked up properly and was clean for the morning and put the chairs on the tables and that sort of thing, and make the night deposit drops. And so we were leaving, and she was making the drop. And just before we headed home, which is also important, my grandmother stopped in at a little convenience store, if you will, it's for a pack of cigarettes. And that clerk still remembers this incident as well, and which is also important. And we were heading back, going off down Route 7, heading towards Great Barrington, and going over this little covered bridge at the time. And the first thing my grandmother remembered from that was lights pretty much bleeding through the floorboards of this bridge a little bit. And she commented on how the headlights of the car didn't seem to make sense with the amount of light or bleed within the bridge. And when we exited the bridge, I was giving my brother a candy, and my grandmother was kind of looking back to see this bleed, to see if that light was still prominent or there,
right,
or have subsided. And when she did, she saw me giving my brother the candy, and my mother, you know, was like, don't give them to him. And my grandmother was a little concerned that he could choke, that kind of thing. And so slowing down and everything as a family in this car, we all saw this light again. and our headlights were like facing forward, right? So this light was behind the car off to the left. And sure enough, this orb, if you will, or sphere, which was very similar to what we saw in the home years earlier, but much, much bigger. This was about the size of four Volkswagen Beetles, if you will. And I've never said it came out of the water. That was a, you know, I don't know where it came from. I just know that it was below the bank of the river.
Okay.
And it rose up, and it was maybe, I don't know, not even 100 yards away from me, or the car.
So it seemed to be lying in wait beneath the bridge.
Yeah, but when we came into the bridge, you would have thought we would have seen it.
Yeah.
You know? But it could have been there. Maybe it just wasn't illuminated. And that's something else that's interesting, because after it, we had, well, while we were looking at it, and it rose very slowly, and it had like a self-contained light now. It wasn't putting off a bleed of light, if you will. And it was like a solid object. I mean, it was, it looked, again, almost like a bubble with an internal light to it, like a self-illuminated 2-watt bulb. And it rose up, and it started going in a direction of our vehicle. Now, Discovery Channel said it was over our car. It wasn't over our car. It was off to the left, off to the driver's side. And as it went forward in the same direction that we were, there was a line of trees that divided the road from our car and this open field where this sphere, if you will, started to travel forward. Now, it was up about 2 stories maybe. And as it slowly moved behind these trees, suddenly we could see light again, just as we did with the bridge. So it had a light that it could project and a light that it would kind of retract and be self-contained again. Because this is now the second time that it gave out a bleed of light. So as we were going down this dirt road and this thing was on the other side of the trees, we started to see this bleed of light coming through the trees. So my mother, again, said, you know, let's look at this thing, basically, right? So she pulls the car off to the right side of the road, which, well, there was a telephone pole there, and looked over this open area of basically grass, and now it's a cornfield, and there was nothing there. And that bleed of light was gone. My brother was sitting to the right of me in the back of this Bel Air station wagon, and he noticed off to the right, because we're looking for it, right? So he's turning his head trying to find out where it is, and he sees a sphere, if you will, off to the right side. Now, this was further away, maybe well over 100 yards away, but it was orangey, and it was lower to the water. It was pretty much where we had originally seen this white orb or sphere off to the left, basically about the same distance off the water as when we first saw the white one. This one was orange, like an orange, and it looked smaller. And so with that, you know, my brother's looking off to the right. We're looking at this one, trying to find the other one off to the left. So we're all kind of like looking around in the car. And as our eyes adjusted, we now saw what looked like a disc, if you will, or a metallic object of some kind, hovering maybe 3 stories up, way off to the left side of the car. And it was massive. I mean, this thing was big, much bigger than it. We had a power to it that was just, it was miraculous. It was unbelievable. This thing was tall. It looked like a turtle shell. I've described it as a turtle shell since day one. It looked like it had a bit of a glow to underneath it. Underneath it, it had a little bit of glow. You could barely see it, but it was there. And, you know, you were sitting there, and now everything started feeling kind of odd. We were feeling like we were underwater to a degree. If you know how that little sounds that you hear seem to amplify, or they echo, if you will.
Right.
We felt sluggish. We felt all of us were feeling this way. And so I believe that what had happened at that point, we were in the middle of 3 moving parts. The white sphere, if you will, even though we didn't see it, was still there. The orange one was off to the right, and then this craft, if you will, or object or vessel, was in front of us off to the left side of the vehicle on the driver's side. We were smack in the middle of these 3 moving parts, and every one of them was slightly moving.
But only one of them was a metallic object, right?
Correct.
Wow.
The one off to the closest one to the front of the car.
Right.
Now, I remember, like, hearing the sounds of the little bit of stones hitting the underside of the fender walls when we slowly went to stop in that telephone pole. Mm. So even as we drove forward in the very beginning of this, there was an effect on the vehicle. There was an effect on us. There was an effect on the environment because it had gone from normal noise, if you will, you know, a bird or what have you. There was nothing. It was just sterile. Mm. And that's why I say underwater, because everything seemed muted.
Mm.
And with the exception of a few tones or sounds that seemed very loud. And so I'm sitting there, I'm looking at my mother and looking at my grandmother a little bit, but it's still dark. And all of a sudden, bang, there was like this light that engulfed the inside of the car, which I have to assume, and I am assuming, that it was that white sphere that had come closer to the car.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was nothing else that would have, I can't think of anything. It wasn't like something shot out of the metallic object. All of a sudden, the inside of the car just lit up like someone had floodlights inside the vehicle.
Okay.
And I could see the dashboard. I could see my mother. I remember seeing my mother's hair and the glove box and seeing my brother. So this light was just inside the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the light went out. There was an eruption of like crickets and katies. All of a sudden, everything around us just erupted. There was all this noise and sound, and it just seemed so amplified. And that was the last thing I remember from sitting in the car at that time.
So, at this point, when you hear the crickets, was the object still there or had it gone?
Oh, I don't even remember. I just remember the eruption, the noise, and the light went back out, and
because
that was it.
The reason I ask is, with my sighting and many other sightings, everything is still. We had crickets at our house all night long, chirp, 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 right?
Yep.
During this sighting, not one sound. It's like the crickets are saying, what is this?
Yeah.
What's going on here?
That's a good question, too, because we don't remember anything involving that moment after that eruption of crickets and Cadians. I mean, that was basically the last thing. And
mm-hmm.
And that light was so bright inside the vehicle that I don't even know if my eyes would have adjusted at that point, you know, to even look. But everything happened. It seemed to happen so fast. I'm not saying it did happen fast,
mm-hmm.
but it certainly appeared to have happened fast. So
right.
To sum this up a little bit, we're coming through the bridge. We see the sphere. We pull off to the side. Everything at that point still seemed normal at some degree. And all of a sudden, everything slowly just kind of changed into this weird funk. So we believe that maybe this energy that we were, you know, surrounded by, maybe it was affecting the neurons in our you know, our brain or what have you. Maybe there was an effect like that because whatever it was affected everything around us. It wasn't just our family that had gone kind of mute or become lethargic.
Right.
And it controlled everything. Like you said, it was, you know, it affects the wildlife.
Right, it does.
And so I've always wondered, you know, what hit my head? You know, what was it that hit our heads like that? What affected us like that? But to be honest with you, everything else was just so much more bizarre after that. I mean, it was just... you know, it was even hard to talk to in the restaurant with, you know, this
right.
whole event just divided our family, divided the town. I mean, I remember being in what resembled a large hangar now.
Oh, I want to get into that, but I need to take a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with contactee, Mr. Tom Reed. Now, tell us, Tom, where you were going with this. What happened? How did you feel? What do you remember of that?
All right. So, when these frogs and crickets and all that just erupted. I don't know who removed us from the vehicle. I don't know how we got to where we were. It was just almost like I was out, perhaps. I don't know. But I remember coming to, as a word I'm going to use right now, and I was sitting on some type of a cart, some type of a table type of thing, because I actually remember sliding off and getting to my feet. And I was in what resembled a large airplane hangar. I'm not saying it was an airplane hangar, but that is the closest thing that I can, put forth that would resemble what I vaguely remember.
All right.
Because it was a huge open area. And where I was, if this was a football field, and that's about the size of where I was, it was almost like a football field, I would have been maybe at the 5-yard line and like off to the side, like in a corner. And so everything basically in this area was off to my left. And there were what looked like, what resembled, single lights that would look like a fluorescent light, like a 4-foot or 3-foot fluorescent tube of light. And it was where the ceiling met the wall. There was a light, a space, a light, a space, a light, a space. And it was just putting off enough light that I could actually see in this open area. And there was nothing in there. I mean, it was dull, but I could still see enough. And the next thing I remember, I'm grabbed very abruptly on my left arm. And I'll never forget that. It actually hurt. I was grabbed by my left arm, and I was pushed forward. I never really got a clear picture of who this person was. Was it a person at all? I'm not really sure. But I was brought, crossed this field, if you would, a football field like thing. I was like right across the 5-yard line to the opposite 5-yard line, if that's the best way to describe it. And there was a door there, and there was an individual there as well. And I was taken down a hallway to the right, and I went maybe, I don't know, 30, 40 feet, I don't know, and took a left and another right again. These were very tall, narrow hallways, if you will. It wasn't, didn't curve to the left or curve to the right. These were lefts and these were rights. The ceiling seemed high to me. Now, I will be honest with this part of it because I don't know if I, you know, I was very young and small, right? So things did seem a little bit bigger to me.
Right.
But these were ceilings that were much higher than the ceilings in our home. So I'm guessing maybe 10 or 12 feet high. They were high ceilings and very narrow hallways. And I remember being brought into a room off to the right. And when I came into this room, or was brought into this room, I should say, one of the walls, it was again to my left. I was to sit up on this table again. Was very, it resembled to some degree like maybe an MRI room. We've got this bowed in glass. And the center bowed in like a coffee can. And there was a pocket to the left and a pocket to the right. And I remember this apparatus, if you will, which was probably the size of a tanning bed, on up towards the ceiling, which eventually lowered, and the table I was sitting on would raise later. And it just seemed very, it was cold, very sterile. It seemed very, this whole incident seemed very militant, very orchestrated. And I saw what looked like an ant figure, if you will. I've always described it as an ant because the head of this thing was about the size of a football. And it, again, resembled an ant to some degree. It's the only thing that I can depict that represents the look of this thing, with the head of a red fire ant. And it had a body that had a teardrop look to it. They had what looked like bamboo legs, if you will.
Some people some people describe these beings as praying mantis.
This does not resemble a praying mantis. I've seen what a lot of people describe. This was very different. The legs of this thing really looked like large bamboo sticks. It had rings around them, almost like a wine-colored ring on both of its legs. The hands were very tight, almost like rods. Very different. Didn't have, you know, and the face again was like an orangey color, a goldish orange. And I've got a pretty good picture of it on the webpage, UFOMonumentPark.com, actually is being redone right now. But, yeah, there were two, of these figures, if you will, and they were to my left, I guess, if maybe at like, I don't know, maybe like 10 o'clock, and they were facing a wall, and they moved almost in a way that I wasn't, I guess now reflecting back, were they really alive? Were they, was it robotic? Was it Uncanny Valley? I don't know, but it was very, seemed very cold. One of the heads just kind of turned almost like a, maybe like a security camera would, you know, it just seemed like nothing affected it. It was just its own, doing its own thing. I didn't matter. I got off the table. I ran out the right side exit, which was opposite where they were. This would be about maybe 2 o'clock. And I ran out into an open area, which was, again, was a huge open area, which almost looked like a giant circle with intersecting hallways to it. About the size of like an empty Walmart if it was in a circle. And this hallway to my left, I stood there. It was extremely wide, almost like a four-lane highway with, you know, the distance of that. And to my immediate right was a thinner hallway, and across from me, straight ahead from me, was basically, you know, was, these intersecting hallways would have formed like a Y, maybe, like the, a Y, you know, laid across the circle. So the two smaller hallways, if you will, were off to my right, and the fatter one was off to the left. And looking back, I say to myself, well, maybe this was meant to control the flow of traffic. Maybe these smaller Y's area or halls were meant to, you know, filter down where this wider one was or something. That's the only thing I could think of is what this really was for. And I remember being brought back in, grabbed again, and brought back into this room.
Okay, and who's grabbing you? Describe these individuals that are leading you around here.
Yeah, I would, you know, I'd describe them the best I can would be almost like a 4 foot, 5 foot at best, thin looking. They didn't look that unlike a human would. Do they look like what's described as a gray? Absolutely not. Does it look human? It looks like off human. It almost looked like a, you know, a hybrid type individual. It's bald. You know, everyone has big eyes like a gray. I was nearly 10 years old, but there was something not right. I mean, it was definitely not your typical human, but it did resemble a smaller, bald human, but the strength was unbelievable. I mean, it wasn't as if, you know, you would think being grabbed by a smaller person, now I was small too, but being grabbed in my arm like that wouldn't necessarily have hurt like it did. And so there was a strength there. But yeah, you know, bald, yes, larger eyes than normal. I don't remember too much about that, but they didn't scare me. It didn't look that unusual. But like a thin, bald Asian, I guess, with a little bit larger eyes. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, it was a long time ago, but it did seem...
But they're humanoid.
Human, but not humanoid, yeah, but not really human. Not a typical human.
Right, right.
And other, you know, I say ant, but, you know, being that I saw was very different than what a lot of other people describe.
So there were different, there were different species there.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I got to ask myself, you know, again, I say to myself, you know, I was young. I was scared, right? This was very different to me. And I... You know, so, you know, just because someone knocks on your window at night when you're watching television and you jump or you're scared doesn't mean it was meant to scare you, right? But you're frightened by it. And I was frightened by this, even though maybe there wasn't a real reason to be frightened. But I was scared.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that, too, is there were times where I was calm. I was very relaxed. And all of a sudden, I'd seem to come to my senses again and be very frightened. So whatever this was that was taking control of my feelings or my or this calmness that I was feeling on and off was controlled at will. Not by me, but it was controlled.
Yeah.
And so I ran out, I came back, all of a sudden I remember cooperating is the word for it. I remember I was just following what they said. And I laid down on this table and the table kind of rose and this piece came off the ceiling and it lowered over my body and the piece separated into two. And there were actually holes through both of these pieces that lowered from the ceiling. And as the top one or the one closest to me on the table, as it lowered, the second one above it came afterwards and then kind of lowered around it. So these holes lined it up over my body. Now, I was not held tightly. I could still see my feet. I had probably 6 or 7 inches between my body and the top of this cage, if you will, or carriage. So I could have run if I wanted to, but I didn't.
Hmm.
You know, I allowed whatever it was to happen. I went with it.
And do you remember?
Yeah, moments before, I was scared enough to run out the corner of the room.
Yeah. Do you remember these things consciously? Did you remember them consciously from the time of the incident to today?
Of course, yeah. I was
okay.
Yeah, this isn't something from hypnosis or anything. I mean, and not only did I remember this, so did my brother, so did my grandmother, so did my mother, and so did a lot of people who went to school with me. This is where I'm going with this, with all these kids in the diner and stuff, and why we've spoken, you know, over 50 years, and collectively we actually made history together, because those kids that I grew up with and ate in our diner, I went to school with, they also had taken pencils and whatever, and crayons, if you will, and had drawn these things that were actually taped to the chalkboard in my fourth grade classroom.
So
we were not the only ones who experienced this type of an incident in or around the 1960s.
So they were abducted too. Some of your classmates were abducted as well.
Well, it would appear so.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very careful the verbiage I use or terminology, because I've actually got a contractual agreement with the state to be careful on how I word things, but I actually do.
Okay. Word it the way you know it. You know?
Yeah. I mean, when I was being approached by the Historical Society in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, they had said to me, you know, if we go the extra mile here and put this to a census and do what we believe is the right thing to do, just would you please refrain from certain verbiage so that we don't have egg on our face? I was like, yeah, okay.
Right.
And so I did an electronic signature and away from that.
And the word abducted, the word abducted is one of those no-no words, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so this was, you're an experiencer.
Yeah, but I don't think there were rules on that one.
Yeah.
But I understand it, too, and I get where they're coming from. I mean, if you're going to do something this pioneering and take a, go out on a limb, you want to make sure that,
Right. Well, some people say that they were abducted. Others say they're experiencers because they are part of something bigger than themselves.
Right.
Others just say contactee. One way or the other, they have been contacted.
Yeah.
And you have been contacted, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, to be quite frank with you, there was so much activity back in the area, so many things that we had seen in and around that time that I really don't talk about sometimes, because, you know, sometimes too much is not good. You know, I kind of stick to what happened in 69 because that is what the focus has been on with the news and everything else, and it's current.
Right.
But we saw, we saw what looked almost like a crescent moon, and we had gotten out of the car to look at it and didn't realize that the moon was, you know, over here, not over there. And so we had these two, one looked similar to like a crescent moon, and the other one as a, you know, maybe a new moon, if you will. And all of a sudden, that just shot to the ground in a matter of maybe a half a second. No trail of light, nothing, just right to the ground.
Wow.
And we had seen this orange sphere, if you will, that we had seen in 69. Mm-hmm. We actually had seen it later on.
Right.
And as well did half, probably a good portion of our school, because we were all walking home from school. This is probably around 3:30 or 4 o'clock, and it was in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and we were near a park where everyone went after school. You know, in the winter we sled down it because there was a hill and a picnic bench there, and we were all walking by this park, and sure enough, we saw basically exactly what we had seen in 69 as this orange ball, and it was shooting towards the park. It took like a 90-degree turn, followed the same height above the ground, shot down towards the street, raised up over a home, and dove into the woods. And almost everybody in that park went running into the woods to find this thing, and no one could find it. Now, there was a lot of activity in Great Barrington and Sheffield. And if you look on the, I guess if you just Google BLT research, you'll see where there have been crop circles in Sheffield in 2012 and in 2013, which were recorded, mm-hmm. and which made headlines and as well. And so this activity, and these photos, by the way, of the sphere were also filmed within the last year or two. So it's these spheres are still in the area. Hmm. The craft itself that we saw in 1969 was actually tracked through Pittsfield, Massachusetts. It came through Stockbridge, Lenox, Lee. It went through Great Barrington, over Lake Mansfield, crossed Route 7, and went into Sheffield where we ran into it. It actually came in the direction of where I was riding the horses at the 4-H horse show, but we had gone ahead and then kind of turned around at the diner and were heading back into Great Barrington. So we kind of ran back into it, if you will. Mm-hmm. A woman by the name of Jan Green had actually seen it while driving her car. And the interesting part of this is Tom Jay used to be the radio personality for WSBS Radio. Mm-hmm. And so he was home, but he was a ham operator, ham radio operator at the time. And so he was getting all these, hearing all this chatter on his ham radio about something in the sky. And so he had called the Great Barrington Police Department. And sure enough, there were reports being made to the police department about this craft, the metallic craft. And so he went down to the radio station and got on the air. And it had already been off the air. Got on the air, and, because a lot of it was looped, and said, "Hey, what are you seeing out there? I'm getting all these reports. I just spoke to the police department. You guys seeing anything in the sky? Where is it?" Basically, he was asking, "Where is it?" And sure enough, Jan Green, again, had heard it, drove down to the radio station and pounded on the door of the radio station to say to Tom Jay, basically, if you'd just come outside, you'd see it yourself. But he was in the station and they had no idea he could see it from the actual station. Mm. So then she went down to the police department, filed a report, and she actually was filmed not long ago when the monument was deemed or an historic landmark. So she did that interview. So Jan Green was an important piece of this. Tom Jay was an important piece, the police department, and of course a lot of the kids that we we ate with in the morning, they're still around to this day. Some are bankers, some are historians, some mm-hmm. are, judges, Judge Titus. Now, Judge Titus is instrumental in this. He's very important in all of this because he actually saw the cows that were mutilated. Oh, and, yeah. And he just filmed with Netflix. I can't mention the show, but so there's a lot.
Why can't you mention the show?
Because I got a non-disclosure.
Ah, well, what, you can't tell me after we're off the air?
Yeah.
Because I got Netflix. I want to watch this thing. Okay.
Well, yeah. I'll be happy to tell you off the air. I just can't,
I got it. I got to give you a hard time. You know that.
That's okay.
Okay.
But so my point is this, and this is what I want your listeners to understand, is if you Google Sheffield, Great Barrington activity. Mm-hmm. This has been going on since the mid-60s, and what people are seeing today mirrors what we saw back in the 60s. It's still there.
Oh, yeah.
As a matter of my father, I don't know if you knew this, he was a first selectman of Canaan, mm-hmm. and just over the Connecticut line, and he was approached by someone by the last name of Bletchman, who was very interested in the Hudson River Valley sightings, because the Hudson River Valley sightings were also over water. Mm-hmm. And our incident was over water, and the Hudson River and the Housatonic River are not that far away from each other. Mm-hmm. And so he was working with a man by the name of Muhammad Labadan, who at the time was a head of the Parapsychology Society for the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And
the reason that Mohammed Ramadan was interested in this topic at the time was because SETI was getting ready to launch their new microwavable technology. And so they scheduled this meet at the UN, which was October 2nd, 1992, to just touch base on what if they find something? What are we looking at here? What are the possibilities? And Stanton Friedman was part of that meeting, as Linda Morton Howe was there, I believe, and our attorney. And so our incident, the Great Barrington, Sheffield, Tom Reed UFO incident, was actually mentioned at the United Nations in support of the Hudson River Valley sightings.
Right.
And because of the effect on us personally and the effect on the environment, it also went in support of Cash and Landerman from Texas.
Right.
So, now, well, the listeners are there. My father lost his life on that same date.
Hmm.
Did you know that?
No, I did not. No.
So this is what drove the rekindling of this incident of ours, because my father was a political figure.
Yeah.
And so out of respect for my father, this is how this whole monument thing happened.
Yeah, tell us about that, yeah.
So out of respect for my father, Dr. Howard Reed, because he was advocating the incident in Sheffield and Great Barrington, because, again, so many people were involved in this. There were so many witnesses to this thing that my dad was saying, look, these guys aren't all,
all crazy.
There's too much here to even remotely assume that there's, they're just all hallucinating or something. And, and the fact that it was never a question that those people in the area were seeing these things, because originally they thought, oh, well, you're seeing some experimental thing from manned aerospace, like I mentioned earlier.
Always.
So there was never a question that these people were seeing something. So they already had admitted back in the 60s that, yes, we are seeing something in the sky. It was never a question. Mm. It was simply a matter of what were you seeing. And so my father, with that, that solid support from basically the entire community, advocated it, because he wanted that community and those people who still resided there to have some vindication that, hey, I saw this as a kid, And so because he was so supportive of the community, when he passed on the same day, unexpectedly, under questionable circumstances, the Historical Society, which he was also part of but in a different state, decided to really look into the archives from the radio station, get testimony from these kids who rode those little banana seat bikes back in the day to our little jukebox-inspired diner, right? And so all those, people that were still in the area, or most of them, I should say, gave statements, gave testimony, and their bankers, their judges, Judge Kevin Titus. And so with that, I was asked to take a polygraph test, which I took and passed.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there were the Jan Green, who drove down to the radio station, and with the hope to get Tom Jay to go outside so we'd see it himself. There are police reports that were filed. There was a paper trail. I wouldn't say police reports. That's probably not the best word. Statements. Okay.
Mm-hmm. No.
So there was this paper trail. And the fact that our diner had so many fights in it back in the day, I mean, these guys would, they're farmers, right? So they're up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. They're milking cows by 6. That's why their wives took their kids to a diner in the morning for breakfast, because,
Right.
So by 4 o'clock, a lot of these guys were out having beers with their friends back in the day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd come back to get their kids at the diner. They had a few drinks, and then someone else had a few drinks, and this guy's like, my son or my family saw it too. You can't tell us that we didn't see it. And this other guy's like, what a bunch of crap, because there was a conflict. I mean, this incident had divided the community, but because it divided the community and because our diner actually played a part in this division, they used that. And the way the Historical Society used that, because they said to me, and this is verbatim, if Billy the Kid had only robbed one train, he just would have been another cowboy with a gun. But because those back in the days had altered the railroad, they all became historically significant, and the event was true. So it went to us, the way this was pitched with the state was that did the Reed's Diner and their testimony and, you know, the incident as a whole, did it divide the community? Because if this divided the community, it was historically significant. Mm-hmm. And if it was historically significant because it divided the community, therefore the event as a whole was true.
Right.
And so that is how it got inducted. So it went to the Historical Society. The first time it didn't go through. The second time it did. And when it went to the census, they said, yep, it's historically significant. It affected this community. And bang. And so it got inducted. Then to, you know, rubber stamp it, the Historical Society reached out to the governor's office. And, of course, they wanted someone else to validate what they wanted, you know, what they were doing. And the governor's office, some rep from the governor's office had gotten back in touch with the Historical Society and said that they don't have anyone that specializes in this topic. If we were talking about the Boston Tea Party, maybe there'd be someone that might, you know, dispute something. Right. But we don't have anything to, you know, anybody here who specializes in it. So we're not going to question the paperwork and the years you put into research in this thing. If the Historical Society says they've got enough to say this was, you know, true, then we're not going to dispute it. So he signed a citation and inducted me into history.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
Then comes the monument, right?
Now the monument. Right. Make it clear. I don't have much time I got, but.
Yeah, we got about six more minutes, so.
Okay, so here we go. So, I got inducted into state, and the event got inducted into state. But because this was a community event, and I've always said it was a community event, the town of Sheffield thinks that this should be the Sheffield's event. Okay?
Right.
That's kind of where this feuding started from. And because they filmed, you know, several TV shows there, from Ancient Aliens to New England Legends to the Netflix thing and a couple others that I could tell you off the air,
mm-hmm.
The town is like, we need to get our hands around this thing. So what do we do? Well, the monument was put there by the town of Sheffield. Rhonda and Copeland and Page, the attorney in Boston, actually orchestrated the placement of this monument, which mm-hmm. now is an historical landmark. But it, when it was put there, the town was no longer using this old road, the road that we drove on in 1969. They had barricaded off passage from the bridge on both ends, so you can't drive through it. Therefore, the town legally lost their right-of-way because they failed to continue using it for what it was originally entitled or originally in place for.
Mm.
So they lost it. So now the town is redoing the bridge, reopening the road, and with them opening the road, now they're claiming they've got all this extra easement, and therefore the monument encroached on their easement. Therefore, they wanted it moved, and a lot of this has to do with trying to reclaim the name of the park, rebranding the park, the Sheffield UFO Memorial Park, rather than the Tom Reed UFO Monument Park, so that they can have some control and have some access to the other side of the water, which is actually private property that I lease.
Wow.
But with them having a right of passage, now they have rights, and they can put their little ice cream truck over there, you know, and their little, you know what I mean? So that's kind of what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
However, just today, earlier today, my attorney, my law firm out of Palm Beach, Florida, received a letter from Copeland and Page, the attorneys for Sheffield, and it looks like the monument will be getting returned. And the
right.
bench that was taken, getting right. returned. So it does look like we can settle this amicably,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
There is a lot of there's a lot of moving parts with this thing. And, you know, this is a free to the public park. I don't charge anything. I don't sell a book.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not profiting from this subject. We had a very unique experience, you know, an extraordinary experience, and one that I welcome, and one that I feel privileged to have been part of it.
Yeah, and one that you want to share with the world, you know, and that's great. If somebody, one of our listeners, any of our listeners, want to see this park and monument, where do they go?
It's in Sheffield, Massachusetts, on Covered Bridge Lane. Sheffield is a very small town, but if you Google Great Barrington, you know, that's pretty much where it is. Great Barrington and Sheffield are, you know, just like a mile away from each other. And UFO Monument Park, .com is going to be back up right now, redoing the webpage.
Okay.
Or they can go to Tom. I spell my name Thom, Tom Reed. .net. There's a lot of information on there. Even, you know, just Google Tom Reed UFO Monument Park online. I mean, it's on Yelp. My God, it's pretty much everybody's navigation system when you drive through town.
Okay.
Or drive an area, it pops up.
I suppose if you went through the town of Sheffield, you could ask anybody where that was, right?
Yeah, everybody knows where it is.
Okay.
And that's the thing. It's been so controversial. There's been so many different stories put out there about what happened and this. And of course, there's this other guy with a first name also, Tom, who is writing a book about it. And, you know, his experience was similar to mine, you know, that kind of thing. So he's writing a book about it, Beyond the Stars or whatever it is. And there's a lot of other people in the area, too, that like I said, this wasn't just isolated to us. I mean, this was something that affected a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
And rightfully so, the town deserves their credit, and I've always given them credit for that. But I'm the one who lost his dad.
Yeah.
We're the ones who got it before the United Nations. It was our family that got inducted into state, and, you know, our incident that made history.
Right.
I've never denied Sheffield their rightful due. But at the same time, you don't just go and grab a monument that's been dedicated to our family and my late father, whose name is on it, along with the governor, and just throw it into a storage bin somewhere because you want to rename the park.
Yeah, it all comes down to money, always, always, you know?
Yeah,
For me, it's free.
Matter of fact, I've had Travis Walton there doing free meet and greets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had a lot of my sponsors there. I've had Mike Barr there.
Okay.
We shot Ancient Aliens at my park.
Very good.
Okay,
yeah, so your website, you say you're redoing your website right now, right?
Yeah, UFO Park, UFOMonumentPark.com or UFOPark.org are the web pages or the websites for this particular incident. And, yeah, we're redoing it right now. Sure, we've got there's so much more stuff to put up there. We just want to take off the old stuff and put up the new stuff.
All right.
So right now it's down. But if you go to thomreed.net, there's a lot on there as well.
Okay.
A lot of information.
That's right.
So,
and you'll probably be able to find documentaries on History Channel or Netflix.
Oh, yeah, we were. Yeah, they filmed. Yeah, well, that's the thing. We shot with Discovery Channel, made in that one-hour-long show, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was pretty accurate. It wasn't bad. They just basically took everything and, you know, threw it into, you know, like the mixer, you know what I mean? It was basically true. It was just that it was thrown together differently. And then, of course, we did Travel Channel and we did Science Channel with Mike Barra and a few others. And that one was focused more on my brother.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was New England Legends, which is very accurate.
Okay.
And then the Netflix, we're waiting to see how that comes out. So I guess what I'm trying to say is if you look at these, you're like, well, you know, they're all like, they'll pick certain parts and do a show on it.
Mm.
So if you look at them collectively, you're like, that doesn't look like the last show I just saw. You know what I mean?
So, Tom Reed, I appreciate you coming on the show. And
not at all. I appreciate you having me.
All right. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is UFOImplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 12 noon, when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Listener supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Featuring local and independent artists.
And dolls, you were at the malt shop with Daddy G, and we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the malt shop, where the jukebox is playing, the kids are dancing, and here we are, back in the 50s.
Thank you.